Session called From Rhodesia to Zimbabwe, What Happens When the Gorillas Win. It's a little more upbeat than the session we had yesterday, which looked at some history of the South African situation, how apartheid developed in South Africa. That can be a little depressing to see racism take root and institutionalize. Today, it's a little more upbeat. We look at what is it that blacks are trying to get. There was tremendous bias in our press during the Civil War in Rhodesia against blacks coming to power. There was a lot of fear that it would be a communist government. If the black guerrillas won, there would be a communist government there, and that this would bode ill for the future of U.S. relations with Zimbabwe. So I think now that blacks have won the right to vote in one of those countries in Southern Africa, we would do well to look at that situation and to see what is it they're trying to do. What policies are they setting up? And when we do that, I believe we will find it's much different than what we had feared would be the case. And if that's true, then what basis can we have for continuing fear-based policies in a place like Namibia? There are a lot of parallels between Namibia and Zimbabwe, except that in Zimbabwe, blacks have won the right to vote. In Namibia, they're still fighting for that right to vote. And I believe that our society resists blacks getting the right to vote in Namibia. And the rationale for that is a fear that if they did get the right to vote, a government might come into being that would sponsor policies that we feel would be wrong. So we would do well to look at Zimbabwe now and to see what's happening under black leadership and to ask ourselves if this is really worth fighting against. Most of the presentation today will consist of slides and commentary on the slides. Before we get to the slides, I want to say, I want to do a couple of background things. First of all, as an example that the media interpretation of that we're getting of Zimbabwe now is not much better than it was before blacks came to power, I want to tell, I want to share something that I learned, which was certainly an eye-opener for me. There's a sense in which our media and Western interpretation of a place like Zimbabwe becomes self-fulfilling prophecy. If we think that these guerrillas who have come to power are going to be a disaster for the country, then we tend to interpret everything that occurs there as foreboding of disaster. For example, when I came back from Zimbabwe, I wasn't in the country for more than 2 weeks. And here I read a column on the editorial page of, I think it was a Detroit newspaper, it was one of these conservative columnists. Kirkpatrick, it was, thank you. Somebody's heard me talk about this before, maybe. Yeah. Kirkpatrick had interviewed Ian Smith, the former white prime minister of Rhodesia. Am I going over people's heads when I assume that you know that Rhodesia? Maybe we better do a little background here quick. Here's the Republic of South Africa. Up here is a small country called Rhodesia. Now, South Africa and Rhodesia are different in the sense that South Africa, whites have been living for 300 years, and they number about 15 or 20% of the total population. They are well entrenched. In Rhodesia, they numbered about 4% of the population, and they had only been there for about 100 years. So it was a much less intransigent example of white minority rule. Rhodesia was one of a number of British colonies, which during the 1960s, Britain began to give independence to. Britain, during the 1960s, was coming to the point of saying that they felt they needed to give universal adult suffrage to their African colonies.
Do those two countries abut?
Yes, they do. They share a border. No, they do share a border. That lost my train of thought. Somebody help me out. Where was I? Okay, yeah, UDI, Unilateral Declaration of Independence. That's what the whites did in Zimbabwe, in Rhodesia, when they began to fear that the British government was going to give blacks the right to vote in Rhodesia. Britain was doing this in a number of its colonies. It started doing it because it faced wars in a place like Kenya, the Mau Mau Rebellion. And this caused Britain to decide that they had to give blacks the right to vote in these African colonies. And when they started doing that in a few colonies, people in other colonies saw it coming. And whites in Rhodesia saw the handwriting on the wall that Britain was going to give blacks the right to vote, said never. Not in 100 years will we allow the black population in Rhodesia to get the right to vote. And in 1965 or 66, Ian Smith, who was then the political leader in Zimbabwe, announced a unilateral declaration of independence. It's interesting, there are people like Kenneth Kaunda, now president of Zambia, which was northern Rhodesia, who was a great disciple of Gandhi and led a nonviolent movement for independence in Zambia. Kaunda said to the British, when Smith declared his unilateral declaration of independence, why don't you send down a small show of force and let the whites know that they can't do this? It was illegal. Everyone agreed about that. And Kaunda said, please don't let the whites do this, even if you have to use force. And the British took a very self-righteous position and said, oh no, we don't want to resort to violence. So what we're going to do is use economic sanctions against the Rhodesian nation to bring them to their knees. And they announced that, made a big deal out of it publicly. Kaunda and others agonized over that announcement. British-owned, state-owned companies in Britain illegally violated that sanctions. A civil war began, and over the course of 17 years, many thousands of people lost their lives in Zimbabwe, just as Kaunda had predicted they would. And Kaunda has written a book that I urge all of you to look at. I'm sure it's in the library, called The Riddle of Violence, where this pacifist Christian politician states why he supported the freedom fighters in southern Africa and why he believed that was a less violent course to take than that taken by the British government, which said that it was committed to peaceful change. And Kaunda makes a strong case that sometimes Western governments who say they're committed to peace actually perpetuate policies that create and prolong war. And that we say one thing, but adopt actions that lead to a different thing. And I certainly believe that that's what's happening on the part of the United States policy in Namibia. And that we kid ourselves to think that there is a nonviolent option open in some of these situations. Anyway, there was a long civil war in Zimbabwe, which has left a terrible scar on the country, and you walk the streets and see a lot of maimed people today. And many people lost their lives during that civil war. In the end, blacks eventually forced whites to the bargaining table through a 17-year war, and elections were agreed to by all the parties concerned because they... The whites had come to believe their own propaganda that blacks did not support the guerrillas, which is a contradiction in terms. Guerrilla war is not successful without broad-based popular support.
David, yes? Excuse me a minute. It's hard for me to understand how 4% of the people can maintain a war for 17 years.
Technology is a big factor. Increasingly, I think the presence of computers, that's certainly one of the reasons why South African whites think that they can survive is the use of American computer technology enables a few people to manage the movements of a huge majority.
How many of the 96% were involved in it?
How many actually? Well, it would depend on how you defined involvement. I mean, there were people who went into the bush and took up guns and fought, but they depended on support from people in the villages who had not taken up guns, but who would feed the guerrillas and who would hide them and who would supply them with information. So actually, how many people, so where you draw them, and then there were others who were supportive, but didn't, they were supportive in a moral sense, but not in an active sense. I think an indication of how much support there was for the guerrillas is to be found in what happened when elections took place. And the guerrillas won an overwhelming majority. The whites believed, the whites got a negotiated constitution which assured them of 20% of the seats in the parliament, even though they're 4% of the population. When they came to the bargaining table and agreed to a ceasefire, they did so because they were able to extract from the blacks a guarantee that for, I think it's 20 years, whites would be insured 20% of the seats in the new parliament. And then the whites went and set up a black puppet government, and black puppet political leaders poured millions of dollars into the campaign of those leaders and believed that these leaders would, that between the 20% of the white constituency in the parliament and this black puppet party that they had created, they believed they would be able to control the parliament. Now that black puppet party that they set up and funded with millions of dollars in the campaign won one seat in the parliament. One single seat. Which was a shock to whites in Southern Africa and which was a shock to most of the American media. Even leftist media in this country was shocked at how well the guerrillas did when it came to a vote. So I think that's an indication of broad-based support.
Start to tell us about Kilpatrick's column.
Yes, thank you. All right. Maybe we got enough background now, we can do that. Ian Smith, the white prime minister, who is still a member of parliament. This is not an African society where blacks come to power and put on the firing squad their former oppressors. Ian Smith is a member of parliament in Zimbabwe today. And as such, traveled in this country last fall and got an interview with Kirkpatrick, who reported that under black leadership, the economy was falling apart in Zimbabwe. I ran into the same opinion from the head of one of the largest banks in South Africa, the Standard Bank in South Africa, who I found myself drinking scotch with for 2.5 hours one night in an airport in Zambia. And this guy told me the same thing. The economy is falling apart in Zimbabwe, and he used as evidence of that belief the fact that some consumer goods were in short supply in Zimbabwe today. Now, this is a highly sophisticated international banker. It's true that you can't buy butter. When we were in Zimbabwe last fall, you could not buy butter, which is a luxurious use of dairy products. Milk was sometimes in short supply. Bread was being rationed. And all of this was a new experience. It had never happened in Zimbabwe before. And it was being used by whites and by bankers outside of South Africa and by Kirkpatrick in the United States press as evidence that blacks don't know how to lead their country. And this has long been the thesis of whites. Whites have to be in charge because blacks aren't sophisticated enough to run a complex industrialized economy like the ones we have. Well, I went along to, I interviewed the vice president of the Commercial Farmers Union. Now, the Commercial Farmers Union in Zimbabwe is a union of white farmers. And this guy told me that during the war, he fought against the guerrillas. He spent 6 months of the year in the bush doing everything he could to ensure that Robert Mugabe, now the Prime Minister of Zimbabwe, would never come to power in that country. And he said the day that Mugabe won the elections, he said, our hearts just sank. We thought, you know, we've sacrificed so much all these years trying to prevent this, and now it's come to be anyway. And they just were convinced that this was going to be the worst possible thing for the country, that the whole country was going to go down the drain, it would become communist, godless, the whole works. He told me that after 2 years of working with this government, he's convinced Mugabe's the only one they can work with, that they have to have Mugabe in power, that the guy's pragmatic more than he is idealistic or ideological, and that he's optimistic that there can be a future in Zimbabwe. I said, we have our disagreements, but I find that when I go to the government and that they listen to my concerns. And that they even respond to some of the things that I teach them. If they adopt some policy that I think is disastrous, they are open to my coming along and explaining to them what I think the effects of that policy will be. And if I convince them, and I often do, then they make changes. He said, the government has looked after the farmers in Zimbabwe very well. I said, well, what about the shortages of consumer goods? The fact that you can't always buy
farmers.
These are white farmers.
They looked after white farmers.
The black this is the vice president of the Commercial Farmers Union stating that the black government has looked after the interests of white farmers very well. And I'm sure that the black government would say that that is not because they favor white privilege, but because they recognize that white farmers are an important part of the agricultural productivity in the country right now, and they don't want to lose that productivity. They do want to create some alternative systems of productivity, but they don't want to lose the existing productivity in the interim, or even in the long term. Now, he told me something very interesting, that there's more grain, except for some drought-related problems, and we ought all be praying for rain in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe is currently, in fact, much of southern Africa is currently in the throes of a 3-year drought that is the worst in living memory and is really causing tremendous problems. What the black government is up against is just unbelievable. I mean, they inherit power at the time of an international recession, which has hit the mining industry very hard, and mining has been an important part of the Zimbabwean economy. Agriculture is another important part of that economy, which has been hit hard by a drought. All kinds of problems. He says, except for some drought-related problems, there's more wheat being produced in Zimbabwe today than there was 3 years ago. I said, well, why the shortage of bread? He said, because one of the first things the black government did when they came to power was establish a minimum wage. And suddenly, huge masses of the workforce in Zimbabwe could, for the first time, afford to buy bread and milk. Skyrocketing consumption and creating short-term shortages, which are reported by highly sophisticated international bankers as proof that blacks can't manage that economy, and are reported to us in our press as evidence that it's too bad the blacks got power because they don't know how to manage the economy and it's going to create new hunger in Africa. Nonsense. It's self-fulfilling prophecy. The attitudes we take towards the changes in a place like this become self-fulfilling prophecy because those reports in this press have a direct effect on the decisions that Western investors decide to make vis-a-vis Zimbabwe. A Western industrialist who thinks the country is going down the drain is not going to invest in that country, and if he doesn't invest, the country isn't going to develop the kind of private sector that we say we believe in this society. So that's an illustration that we need to be careful how we interpret the views of Zimbabwe that we get. We need to ask questions about what are the presuppositions underlying the views of these people. One more background sketch, and then we'll go to the slides. Another common, and I'm sure any of you who have read papers, press papers in the last year, are familiar with the notion that, let's just draw a country a picture of Zimbabwe. I hope nobody here knows what Zimbabwe really looks like. You read in the press that there's a real problem of ethnic chauvinism. The press calls it tribalism. I said earlier this week I don't like to use the word tribe because we always use it in relation to Africans or Native Americans. We never use it in relation to the Polish community on the south side of Chicago. And I'm not sure that there's really a difference. So ethnic groups, ethnic chauvinism, ethnic rivalry between different language groups in Zimbabwe is reported to us as a severe problem, and it is a big problem. But I think that it is one which is being whipped up or encouraged by white colonialists. Whites in Africa have long known that the best way to govern the Africans is to set them off against each other, and that's continuing in Zimbabwe today. And there's a long history of it. Now in Zimbabwe, you've got, roughly in this part of the country, a group of people who speak the Shona language. They speak the Ndebele language. And in most of the country, the dominant language is Shona. The Shona people are the original inhabitants of Zimbabwe, or if not original, they were there before anybody else who is now living in Zimbabwe was there. The Ndebele people, some of you remember yesterday when I spoke about the Difakani, the scattering of the peoples in South Africa, because of the militarism of a Zulu king named Chaka. When that happened, a group of people who were living further to the south came north. They adopted some of Chaka's military techniques. It's amazing, you look at world history, and you learn how militaristic policies breed the spread of militarism. That's exactly what happened in this situation. You had a Zulu king down here who adopted military policies, used them against the surrounding peoples who were forced to scatter, to flee that guy, and in fleeing, they adopted some of his militaristic tactics, and then used them to gain control of the Shona people. So the Ndebele people are the invading, conquering ethnic group in Zimbabwe's history. Until the whites came along in about 1890 and conquered the Ndebeles and maintained control over the whole situation. Now, when the war developed in Zimbabwe, you actually had two guerrilla armies that fought. Most of the Shona, they were not exclusively ethnocentric. In other words, they were not not all of the Zama forces. Not all of the Zama forces spoke Shona, but most of them did. Not all of the Zipra forces spoke Ndebele, but most of them did. Zama was the political wing of a political party called ZANU, which is today in power, has a clear majority of the seats. And a minority political party in Zimbabwe today is ZAPU. ZANU is led by Robert Mugabe, current Prime Minister of Zimbabwe. ZAPU was led by Joshua Nkomo. Okay? Nkomo's in Ndebele, Mugabe is Shona speaking. And these two armies fought separate battles against the whites during the Civil War in Zimbabwe. They did create an alliance of sorts, but it was always an uneasy one. My personal opinion, and I'd identify that as very much a personal opinion, is that I don't trust Nkomo any farther than I can see him. He is the preferred of these two by the Western media. He has always been, because he stayed in the same kind of fancy hotels that Western journalists stayed in during the war. When they had so-called peace conferences in Geneva, Mugabe and his people would stay in third-rate hotels and didn't like talking to the Western media because they inevitably got misquoted, and so they just said, well, you know, nuts, if you guys aren't going to report what we say, we're not going to talk to you. Nkomo stayed in very fancy hotels and wore beautiful suits that look good on television and would talk to the Western press and has always been preferred by them. I don't trust him. I think he's highly ambitious. He held secret talks with Ian Smith right before the war ended. After the war, his party wrote letters to the Soviet Union and said, now Mugabe's party has come to power and it's time for us to make our move. Please send us $60 million worth of weapons, which were brought into the country and were, thank God, found before they were used by the government. So there is a great tension that continues between these two groups, I think largely because the Ndebele people think of themselves as superior to the Shona people, and they were in charge before the whites came, but are a minority and can't handle the reality of the democratic process, which gave a clear majority of seats to Mugabe's party when the elections were held. Now, that problem of ethnic rivalry will come up in a few minutes when we start looking at some slides. Anybody want to raise questions about it now before we move on?
What's the percentages of the population? Do you remember?
I don't know. The Shona have a clear majority. That seems to be well established. I've heard 3/4 of the African people are Shona, but I even hesitate to repeat that.
Sure. Yeah. What is the Christian influence in Zimbabwe?
Zimbabwe has a very strong Christian presence. I don't have statistics on how many.
What is Mugabe?
Mugabe was educated in Roman Catholic mission schools and is himself a Catholic. He may not be at Mass every Sunday, but he has said that he has a great deal of respect for the teachings of the Catholic Church. He wishes that the Church would be more consistent about carrying out what it teaches and has been critical of the Church in that sense. He is also one who says that he has read the writings of Marx and that he thinks Marx has a lot of good things to say. And so for that reason, in our press during the war, he was consistently labeled as a Marxist. I never, not once, in the press saw him called a Catholic. And I believe that both labels are legitimate to pin on him.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Are the resources of the country clearly in one section or the other?
They're spread out. They're spread out. There's mining resources all over the country.
Where's Nkomo today?
The last I heard, he had gone to Britain. This is a real complicated situation, and it's hard to draw the line between, there have been when blacks came to power, the new black government inherited three different armies. There was a white army, there was Nkomo's army, and there was Mugabe's army. And they tried to put all of these three armies together. And in a sense, two of the armies were really very bitter about what had happened. It was only Mugabe's army that was pleased. And there have been a lot of problems in putting that army together. And at one point, particularly after the massive arms caches were found on Zapu-owned farms, in strategic points scattered around the country. That happened about a year and a half ago. And when that happened, large numbers of ex-ZIPRA army members who were in the unified Zimbabwe army fled, taking their weapons into the bush with them. Came into this part of the country and began agitating the rural people to say that this new government doesn't represent us and we need to resist it. Now, they fled into the part of the country which is heavily, which raises cattle, where there were white cattle farmers, and they came into this area after the drought had gotten started. Now, when the drought came along, the white cattle farmers recognized that they were going to have problems getting drinking water for all of their cattle this year, and so what they did was make a strategic decision. They said, my farm can accommodate X number of head of cattle, and I better get rid of 300 head of cattle and slaughter them right now, or else I'm going to be in trouble. They cut back their herds in order not to deplete their land. The rural African people, for whom cattle is a very important symbol of value, they don't put their money in banks, they invest in cattle. That's how a rural African does it. They did not slaughter off their cattle supplies, with the result that their cattle were dying of thirst. Enter the situation, these armed ex-ZIPRA combatants, the white farmers had been disarmed. These renegades, rebels, ex-ZIPRA combatants, had left the army, entered the situation with their guns, went to their rural people, and said, look at that farm over there. We fought a war in order to over the issue of land, and here this white farmer still has all this land and is doing fine. His cattle aren't dying of thirst. Your cattle are dying of thirst. They cut the fences, they moved cattle in, and there were some situations in which white farmers tried to stand up to that and were killed by these rebels, creating tremendous pressure on the part of the white farmers in this region who were saying to Mugabe's government, you've got to do something about this. You took our guns away, and now you've got a situation where there are rebels moving in and causing problems. And that dissident activity has been going on continuously since blacks came to power, has gotten worse at times. And last fall, Mugabe's army, largely Shona-speaking people, moved into the situation and, according to several reports, apparently went on a rampage which killed a lot of civilians, and which is indeed a tragedy and something that the Catholic Church in Zimbabwe, which has been very supportive of the Mugabe government, came down very hard in critique against Mugabe. There have also been incursions by South African, members of the South African army who have come up here to cause trouble. While I was in Southern Africa last fall, four white members of the South African Defense Force, so-called Defense Force, were shot and killed in this region of the country by members of the Zimbabwean army. And they were found with papers on their body indicating that they were on a mission to blow up a railway link between Zimbabwe and Mozambique, because the Zimbabwe government has said, we want to end a situation in which we are so economically dependent on South Africa. And we're going to do that by increasing economic cooperation with our other black states in the neighborhood, like Mozambique. So they're trying to begin importing their oil through Mozambique instead of getting it through South Africa. Now, every time that oil pipeline gets ready to open, it blows up very mysteriously with very sophisticated explosives. There's no doubt in my mind that the South Africans, who recruited large numbers of members of the Rhodesian army the White Rhodesian Army, recruited them into the South African Defense Force after blacks came to power here. And South Africans, I'm thinking of doing a whole session next week on the secret wars of South Africa. We hear about the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. There's a whole war on the part of the South Africans, which has been going on vis-a-vis Mozambique. They have bombed Mozambique. They have regularly infiltrated Zimbabwe and caused incidents which embarrass the government and which economically sabotage it. One of the unrivaled military advantages that South Africa has in the whole region is its air force. And the Zimbabwean government bought very sophisticated jet fighters from Britain. And a week after they arrived in the country, those jets blew up on the runway in Zimbabwe. The South Africans have invaded Lesotho, killing 42 people in a blatant daylight raid. I mean, they just took army, they invaded the country and just killed 42 people. And there's a wide-scale invasion of Angola that has been going on for over a year and a half. There's been a continuous South African military presence in Angola for over a year and a half, to say nothing of the illegal presence in Namibia. And none of this is getting press in our newspapers, and all of it has been growing very rapidly ever since our last presidential election. All right, let's look at some slides. Somebody want to turn the lights off, and if someone up there by the slide projector would turn that on, I'd appreciate it. Yes, please. Zimbabwe is not your stereotype of a underdeveloped country. One of the ironic effects of the long of economic sanctions during the Civil War was that Zimbabwe was forced to become much more economically self-reliant than most African countries. And today, blacks have inherited that self-reliance. This is a beautiful park in downtown Harare. Harare is the new African name for the city that used to be called Salisbury, the capital of Zimbabwe. These parks are today open to black people. You can't hardly see, but some of the people on the bench in the background there are blacks. They were closed to blacks during white minority rule. In the background, the smoke is coming from the steel manufacturing plant in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe is one of the few African countries that exports manufactured steel. In the foreground is the black African township where black workers for that steel mill were forced to live regardless of their skill level. There was the black township where black workers for the steel lived, and then there was the white township. In this relatively nice house, this is one of the nicest houses in the black township, this is where a man named Shanusa lived. Shanusa was highly skilled as a black worker. He had gone as high in the skill category as blacks were allowed to go during the Civil War. After the Civil War, he continues to get promoted, but more importantly to him, he's been able to move into the white suburb. So he moved from that previous house you saw into this one, and that's a symbol of very meaningful changes to the black middle class in Zimbabwe, which had been confined to a very poverty-stricken situation and which now is able to move on. But most of the people in Zimbabwe are rural and poor. These women are farm laborers. It's a family which lives on a white-owned farm in this little compound. And most of the black people in Zimbabwe live in the rural areas and are very poor. And the policies of the Zimbabwean government are designed first and foremost to improve the way of life for rural people. This is different from what you found in many African countries where a black elite gained power and immediately proceeded to create all kinds of advantages and benefits for the urban elite, with the result that there was a massive transfer from the rural areas to the urban areas. Now, the next three slides, including this one, will point out one of the policies of the Zimbabwean government, which is designed to stem the flow from the rural to the urban areas, to stem that urban migration. What they have done here is take a rural site, and there are 52 of them that have been identified throughout the country, called rural growth points. Take a rural site, pave a road. Here you see the road coming in. I think it was about 20 or 30 kilometers away is major paved highways that connect this rural place with the rest of the country. It had been a dirt road. The government paved the road into this rural village called Kinsey. Then they paved what was a dusty center of the village where the country buses gathered. Put up that roof that you see in the background there, built concrete stalls underneath it, and have created a new town center in an inner region where a lot of peasant farmers live who grow sunflower seeds for sunflower oil. Now the idea is to create a new town which will help these rural farmers get their goods to market. And by creating a new town here, they hope to stem the flow of migration from the rural to the urban areas and creating all kinds of new urban problems. What they're doing here is the women underneath their market stall, and in the background you see some new buildings that have just gone up. Other plots of land have been surveyed and bids are being taken, one for a grocery store, one for a dry goods store, one for a hotel, and any other kind of business that the government decides might be relevant to the formation of a new town. They take bids from local capitalists. Keep in mind, this is the policy of a government that we were told in no uncertain terms would bring communism to the country. A heavy reliance on the capitalist sector to implement its new policies designed to benefit rural development. By taking bids from local entrepreneurs and in effect creating a new town where there had been a very dusty, sleepy village, and hope that and we'll create 52 of these new towns around the countryside as a way of bringing urban development to the rural areas instead of having people come. While I was in Zimbabwe, I was very fortunate to that an international rural conference on rural development technology was taking place. Now, this is one of the interesting things about Zimbabwe, that it can speak with integrity to its black neighbors, but that it also has the economic infrastructure to attract Western industrialists. Here's the British Pavilion, a highly capital-intensive exhibition. The whole point was to bring together Africans from all over the continent, but especially in Southern Africa, and to exhibit rural development technology, technology that would benefit rural people. Also to bring together Western manufacturers and representatives of African governments. One of the problems is, how does the government of Mozambique, which might want to start up some new businesses, how do they communicate with Western industrialists? You have to have a time to bring all these people together. And most of the trade conferences that exist in the world exist in Western industrialized countries where these African governments can't get to or don't go to. In Zimbabwe, they had this convention which brought together a fascinating array of people, from the British exhibition to the French exhibition, which was trying to sell highly capital-intensive projects like breweries, to these women from rural Botswana who had developed a stove that used potsherds, cattle wastes, to as an energy source. There's a tremendous problem of deforestation in Africa and a lack of wood. And these women had set up their exhibit and were cooking dinner for folks on their new stove that they were marketing. And the dinner was a highly preferable alternative to the sort of food that you get at conferences, you know, where you pay a lot of money in a cafeteria for lousy food. These women were offering cheap food, which was much more substantial and much better tasting, as a way of marketing their state. You had these rural Botswana women side by side with big French and British and American industrialists. The American Pavilion was one of the most fascinating because they had brought together East Coast hucksters who were had some fancy technology, and this guy was going on and on and on about how he had the greatest invention since the discovery of the wheel and it was going to revolutionize all of Africa. You had that guy standing next to some hippies from the farm in Tennessee, which is a relatively successful communal farm in Tennessee, and they were marketing solar-powered radios. And had one of the most successful exhibits at the whole thing. It was a fascinating bringing together of Africans and Western industrialists. This was a project that had been developed in Tanzania to make use of waste oil. Used car oil came out of one of those faucets and mixed with water from the other faucet. Here you see the car oil coming down from the one pipe down this trench with just the right drop of water that mixed into the thing, and it dropped through a hole onto a fire where it ignited. They had found a way to burn used waste oil, and this particular technology had been developed by a baker in Tanzania who used this heat source to run his bakery. Very little money to set up this project, but you need to know how to do it. You need the plans. And here were these people passing out, free of charge, the plans on how to set up this technology. All right. Just a moment of introduction to the next set of slides that we're going to see. I mentioned the rural growth points as an example of the policy of the Zimbabwe government. Another policy which they're setting up is dedicated to is cooperatives. They don't want to undermine the private sector's agricultural productivity in Zimbabwe, but there is the strong belief that while Westerners who are highly individualistic may need capitalist type economy to be productive, there is the belief on the part of the Zimbabwean government that Africans who have a very communal orientation might be able to be productive in a cooperative setting. And they're setting up various kinds of cooperatives. One kind of cooperative is where they get a big piece of land and divide it up into small-scale farms and then cooperatively share the use of certain equipment, like a tractor. That's one type of cooperative. A second type of cooperative, which is they're finding more difficult to set up just because it, not because they've tried to do it and it doesn't work, but because they just haven't got the money to set it up. I mean, the Americans, for example, which are one of the highest dollar donors to the new Zimbabwean state, give all of their money to strengthen the private sector. The United States does not offer any foreign aid which helps the Zimbabwean government set up its priority of cooperatives. The next several slides we're going to see are slides taken of the Vukuzenzele cooperative. Vukuzenzele is an Ndebele word that means wake up and help yourselves. And the leaders of this cooperative told us when we visited them that what they had fought the war for, they were all ex-combatants in Joshua Nkomo's army. They said what we fought the war for was the opportunity to become self-reliant. Sounds amazing to us that people would fight a war for the opportunity to be self-reliant. He said blacks in this country under white leadership have been forced to become economically dependent on the whites, and we want the right to be self-reliant economically. And they were setting up this cooperative in an effort to do so. Now, the interesting thing about the cooperative is that it is Ndebele-speaking ex-members of Joshua Nkomo's army who have been given a piece of land in the middle of a Shona-speaking community, which was dominated during the war by Robert Mugabe's army. It's exactly the prescription for civil war that every white person in Zimbabwe today will tell you is inevitable. The whites all say that the whole thing is going to degenerate into civil war because tribalism is such a problem and blacks can't get along with each other, and that's why they need white leadership. Here is an example of Ndebele-speaking people who have set up a cooperative in a Shona-speaking neighborhood and where they have good community relations. The first thing they did was pitch tents and bake their bread in this earth oven. They lived like they lived during the Civil War, out in the bush. And then they started clearing land to set up a garden, because agricultural self-sufficiency was one of their first priorities. Now, the gardens that they had set up were very impressive. You're looking at this garden at the end of the dry season. And every inch of that garden is watered by hand-carrying buckets of water from a little stream that doesn't always run. The local Shona neighbors, who were very suspicious when these Ndebele people first came into their neighborhood, said, you will never be able to get water out of that stream because it only runs once in a while. And they have taken as a sign of a good omen the fact that the stream managed to continue through the first year of operation, to the point where Shona-speaking neighbors are now buying vegetables out of this garden. The members of the cooperative, about 100 men, and they hope to get to the point where someday they can afford the luxury of bringing their families to live with them at this cooperative, but in the early stages, that's just, they have to see that as a luxury.
They've set up a highly impressive garden where they're selling produce. They're feeding themselves and selling excess produce to their local neighbors. This is Sly, a highly charismatic leader of the cooperative who showed us around. And it was interesting, any of you have had Peace Corps experience working agriculturally in Africa, you know that you can spend a whole 3-year term trying to get the local peasant farmers to use fertilizer. They say, well, we've never used fertilizer before, why should we do it now? There's a real conservatism on the part of those rural peasant farmers. These guys were not only using fertilizer, they were all over us as soon as we arrived to please send them information about a new gardening technique they had heard of called the raised bed gardening methods, the French intensive gardening method. They were highly progressive in their gardening techniques, and I think the reason for that was they had learned during 17 years of living in the bush as guerrilla farmers, guerrilla fighters, that the way we've always done things is not the way to the future. That we need to introduce new ideas and experiment with new techniques to pursue a new future. And it was their hope that this example would rub off on their neighbors. As Sly said to me at one point, you know, during the war, we had to convince most of the rural African people that it was necessary for us to fight for our independence. That we had to stand up to the whites and actually take power away from them, that they were never going to give it to us. He said, now, after the war, we also have to convince our people that it's necessary to pursue new methods by which we struggle to become self-reliant. And I think his proudest moment during the 2 days that we visited him was when he took us several miles away down to a local river and showed us these new gardens that had recently sprung up, that were being put together by the local Shona neighbors. He was proud that the neighborhood was starting to set up gardens, whereas traditionally they hadn't done so because they said, well, the wild game will eat all the vegetables if we do that. Well, the cooperative had come up with a fencing method of using wooden sticks that kept the wild game out. And when the neighbors started eating vegetables out of that garden, they said, well, maybe we should do the same thing. And they went down to, and this was stealing his market, but he was proud of the fact that the neighborhood was learning from their example. In the background, you can almost make out a large new water holding tank. And this trench was being dug down to the river several miles away while we were there. In order to install a pump that would pump water up from a river that had a dependable, constant supply of water. They would put it in that water holding tank, and they were going to use that water to irrigate this new field, which is much closer to them. The gardens you saw involved a 2-mile walk every morning to get to. And now this was much closer to their residential site at the cooperative. They were just clearing that land, and Sly was dreaming out loud about where in the world can we find a tractor. We can just get a tractor. They already had the money and the equipment for the irrigation capability. But he said, once we get that field irrigated, if we can get a tractor, we can go into commercial farming in a big way, and that can be the basis of economic self-sufficiency for us. There was an organization which is supportive of the government's policies, which acts as an intermediary agency between Western donors and rural cooperatives like this one. That organization, called the Zimbabwe Project, helps put together Western money with, well, it's not always, in fact, it's rarely Western money, some European money, but anyway, they help outside donors get together with worthy projects in Zimbabwe, and they came in and said, we're going to help you put up some of your buildings. These are dormitories. You help us. You help supply some labor, work side by side with construction people that we will hire to put up your initial buildings, then we're going to pull out and you'll be on your own. Well, of course, along the way, they learned how to build buildings like this. As soon as they got one of these buildings built, they set half of it aside and established the Vukuzenzele War Disabled. Every member of this cooperative was disabled during the war, every single one of them. The Vukuzenzele War Disabled Cooperative Society Limited Clinic. They set up a clinic which was open to the local Shona-speaking neighbors. And for the first time, that Shona neighborhood had a clinic that they could walk to. as a result of the local initiative to set up the clinic, the government had said, well, we will respond to that local initiative by supplying you with a medical personnel, one medical, I don't think it was a doctor, I think it was a paramedical person, and we'll give you some supplies. But you have to build your own building. These are the new buildings that by now I'm sure they've moved into, which were designed to be a clinic. But it was a symptomatic of their commitment to the clinic and to the health welfare of the local neighborhood, that they would take one of those first dormitories and put the clinic, a temporary clinic, in there until they could get into these buildings. And they said that it was proving to be a source of great community relations for them, that the local neighborhood was coming into their midst every day and using their clinic. This is where they cooked their food for a long time. And by now, I'm sure they've been able to move into a new kitchen that was being built. They had pooled their money and chosen one of their members to go off and learn poultry farming, and had set up a very impressive poultry farming project, which they saw as one of the means by which they would try and become self-sufficient, economically self-sufficient. The week we were there, they had just started rabbits. They had gotten their first rabbits. You see the one in the lower right-hand corner there. And I'm sure by now they have a highly prolific rabbit population. They were all excited because as they took us out to, they had borrowed a truck. They were way out in the countryside, and we had made arrangements in advance to come and see them, which meant that they had borrowed a truck from a sympathetic local white farmer. This land was given to them by a white farmer who heard about these highly frustrated group of war-disabled ex-soldiers who were holed up in a hotel demanding that the government give them some new opportunity. Imagine the challenge the government faced when they took power. Suddenly they had tens of thousands of soldiers who no longer wanted to be military people. They wanted to form cooperatives and to set up farms. And how do you go about giving that kind of an opportunity to people? You especially don't give it to those who have been disabled by the war. And a white farmer who was actually imprisoned by the whites during the war because he was sympathetic to the black struggle, read about these war-disabled members and he decided to give a big chunk of land to them. And so they went to him and said they were having some visitors from overseas, and he lent them a truck. And when they came and picked us up, and we stayed a few days, and then they borrowed the truck again to take us into town where we could hitchhike on to the next place we were going to. And they took advantage of that opportunity to take their first crop of chickens to market, and we're very excited about that. They told us that at the moment they had one of their members who was off learning pig farming, and that they had learned how to build buildings working side by side with those construction people that had built the dormitories, and now they were going to use, they were just digging this foundation to establish a building where they would set up their pig farming project as soon as their fellow member of the cooperative came home with the new skills. In the background you see a new kind of pit toilet that is permanent because of a special concrete sealed system and a complex ventilation system. This toilet, the wastes in this toilet decompose, and you don't have the problem that you usually have with pit toilets where they fill up and you have to move and create a new toilet. In the foreground you see flower gardens. Every member of the cooperative is disabled, as I said, some of them more severely than others. And those who get around in wheelchairs had to also have a meaningful role to play. They did some of the bookkeeping and some of the office work, but they also kept the flower garden. Something that these guys were immensely proud of. In the middle of this barren countryside, you arrive at the main entry place, and you see all these beautiful flower gardens. So much for the Vukuzenzele War Disabled Cooperative. The very kind of activity that our government and our society most fears in a developing Zimbabwe, and which we refuse to fund. I'm going to talk about Zimbabwe. I can see you maybe better than you can see me. Raise your hand if you've ever heard of the Great Zimbabwe Ruins. Those of you who have read Michener maybe have heard about ancient stone ruins that exist in Zimbabwe that date back to the Middle Ages in Europe, between the 11th and 15th centuries, during the Dark Ages in Europe, there was a highly advanced civilization in southern Africa, which had a city of 10,000 that existed among on this site. In the background there, you see that massive wall that we'll see closer shots of in a moment, which was the site of the chief. That's where the chief of all the chiefs in this region of Africa lived. There are some 200 sites where this stone architecture is found, scattered around the countryside, all of which was labeled by the whites as a great mystery. One of the great tourist attractions of the Rhodesians was, come and see the mysterious stone ruins of Zimbabwe. No one knows how they got built. Maybe it was the Phoenicians who came down the coast, or Arab traders, but certainly it was a heresy to the white Rhodesian government to ever insist that they had been built by blacks, because the white Rhodesians maintained that the blacks could never have been so advanced as to have been capable of this kind of architecture. There is no mortar in these walls that are up to 90 feet high and 30 feet thick, and they've been standing for 500 years. No one knows how they were built. It was an advanced society, but clearly they were built by the Shona people because of the number of sites scattered all over the countryside, 200 of them. Most of them are small-scale sites, and the Rhodesian government never publicized and acknowledged that they existed. And then there was this site, which was the chief of all the chiefs, chief of 200 chiefs at this great Zimbabwe site. Massive stone structures that did not have a military purpose. The archaeologist who has studied this more than anyone else was actually banned by the Rhodesians during the Civil War because he insisted on saying that definitely these were built by the Shona-speaking people many centuries ago. Evidence of a proud past that was denied in the educational system of the white Rhodesians, and that is today what the country of Zimbabwe is named after. Barbara was getting tired with all the pictures I was taking, and that's why she looks a little grumpy.
Did the Shonas have any kind of traditions or stories of these kinds of buildings?
Yes, they do, but that was not, you could not talk about that. Mm-hmm. Beautiful stonework, of a highly sophisticated nature, and tremendously complex drainage systems going through these walls, highly sophisticated. Take note of the step architecture that you're looking at here. The archaeologists tell us that nowhere else in the world is this architectural feature found, where these stones kind of gracefully flow out of the line of rock. No mortar in any of this stone architecture. It's all freestanding stone, and it's been there for 500 years. There's a closer look at the stones. This is still in the chief's site. In the background, on top of that hill there, that actually it's a strange part of the country. They have these huge chunks of granite that are actually small mountains. And on top of that hill is where the high priest lived and where the next several shots are taken from. Beautiful use of blending the stonework that they constructed with the natural stone boulders that existed there. This was a very, I can't figure out how they built this. The angles are extreme, and those are steps going down into a tunnel that existed underneath these walls that had a very sharp angle to them. Now, we move from the site of Great Zimbabwe to some of the sub-chief's sites. This is another one that we visited at a place called Nalatali, which exists on a smaller scale, but this particular site did very intricate stonework, making use of a chevron pattern, and you can see some black granite slates that run through there, a line of black granite that is just, they were located high up on top of a hill, but they did not have military purposes. This was a peace-loving people. They were not a militaristic people. And the archaeologists who have studied it say that there is evidence to suggest that these structures could not have been built for military purposes because they had wide open gates. They didn't protect themselves militaristically. too well. Okay, that is some of the past glory of Zimbabwe, as well as some of the examples of what it is that black gorillas strive for. It is a pathetic drop in the bucket compared to what you get from the media about Zimbabwe, but I hope at least serves to caution you to think twice about what we read in the newspapers, that the whole country is falling apart and that it's all for naught. That's as much as I have to present. If those of you want to leave, you may do so, and those who want to stay will take a few questions. One here and two there.
Yeah, I saw the signs there. It's all in English. What's spoken in the schools?
The educational language of the country is English. Has been and will continue to be. Okay. One of the first things the Zimbabwean government did was make primary school education freely available to anyone who wanted it. And they also made health care freely available, which the whites are screaming about. They say, you can't afford to put so much money into education. And the blacks say, education is the best investment we can make.
Big sacks of this wonderful, nutritious stuff, and on the outside it said, this is a gift from the people of the USA.
Right, and I appreciate your saying that, because that is an important part of American foreign aid. The reason I make the points that I do is not because I intend to be unfair, but I feel I have a very limited period of time, and B, I live in a society where we get that message. I get that message when I read my newspapers. I don't get the message that the United States spends a lot of money on foreign aid, that we send food, and that we participate in good constructive projects.
And we do.
Well, see, I have to make choices about what to present. And I have a very limited period of time, and I don't think that there's any absence of understanding that the American people do participate in good, generous projects.
They don't help the people down here, but they do. A lot of people just send their kids to school for that one nourishing meal they get that's made out of milk and corn and soybean. And boy, do they like it. They like it better than the education in many cases.
Well, I appreciate your balancing what I said. I feel that there is virtually no one, or there's very little perspective of the kind that I bring, and that it is very prominent on the part of many African leaders that the United States, I mean, in Zimbabwe, there is a concern that we will not fund anything except the private sector. That the government has this stated policy of setting up cooperatives, and that the U.S. will not fund the assistance, you know, will not help them set up those cooperatives.
I don't know about Zimbabwe, but that's off Botswana.
Yeah, well, Botswana is also considered by some to be a satellite state of South Africa, and that we actually protect our interests in South Africa by helping to pay the bills of Swaziland, Lesotho, and Botswana. That's a very strong school of thought in Africa.